Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Jonathan Den Hartog, an associate professor and departmental chair of history at the University of Northwestern in St. Paul, Minnesota. More importantly, regular listeners will remember that Jonathan has appeared twice on the show with us before, once for a solo appearance where he informed us about the piety of John Jay, and another time where he debated two other scholars about what recourse Christians should have taken during the Revolutionary War in the United States. During those podcasts, we noted that he was working on a book manuscript, and we can now announce that this manuscript is now a full-fledged book that was published just a month or so ago. The name of that work is Patriotism and Piety, Federalist Politics and Religious Struggle in the New American Nation. We will link to that book, which, by the way, has a very striking cover, on our webpage, as well as a link to Professor Den Hartog's own website, historicalconversations.wordpress.com, where he blogs about none other than historical conversations. I know that our history-based interviews are among our most popular, so I am sure that you folks will find some good stuff over at that website as well, so please visit it. Jonathan, welcome back to Research on Religion, scoring a hat trick, one of only a small handful of people who can actually say that.
Well, thanks so much, Tony. I really appreciate being on. It's always an honor. It's always a joy to chat with you about important issues about religion in American history. Now, two things come from that introduction, I think. One is, if we're getting all of our tech talk out of the way, let me also let our listeners know that I'm also on Twitter.
Ooh.
And that they can follow at jdenhartog1776 on Twitter. So, you know, that 1776, I think they can figure that out. That's kind of revolutionary based. The other thing is, with that introduction, since I'm living in the frozen tundra of Minnesota right now, I know what a hat trick is. There was a whole lot of hockey talk on the radio coming in, so I'm happy to be there, and hopefully I'll sit in the crease for this interview and put some real great answers into the net.
Oh, we are sure you will. Yes, we'll make sure that we link to your Twitter feed and also remind us that we have a Twitter feed as well, so people can look at that. Hey, but congratulations on the new book. I noticed that you posted that on Facebook when it came out, and it has a really cool title. Does it feel good to have that book in your hands now? Does it have that good new book smell to it?
Yeah, it feels great. This project was a long time coming. As we said, we've done several interviews where we said, well, it's coming. But now for it to be here is a really fun experience. It actually, the very first copy arrived about 2 days before Christmas, and I said, wow, I would find it hard to imagine a better Christmas gift. So to really, you know, feel the final product in the hand is just a really great feeling.
It is an absolutely great thrill, and congratulations on that book. Now, if I recall correctly, when we did have you back a while ago on that great debate of whether Christians should have taken up arms during the U.S. War of Independence, you were all in favor of gunning up. Are you still good with that position, or have you gone soft after a few years?
Yeah, I don't feel a need to recant. I think I'll hold my ground. I think people should listen back to that one if they haven't heard it, or if they have and they just want to freshen their thinking up. I'm still pretty convinced that the colonists were right in thinking that they needed to defend themselves and that things were moving fast enough that now is the time to take up arms.
Well, we will point listeners back to that podcast. It is a unique one because we did feature three scholars debating with one another, and so please go check that out. But let's get back to your book, and I mentioned in the introduction that your new book, Patriotism and Piety, has a pretty awesome cover. We'll put a picture of it on our Facebook page, but let me try to describe it here. It appears to be an editorial cartoon, a black and white line drawing or etching, with some guy holding a rope in his hand that is wrapped around a column. And then he has a bottle of something below him, which I imagine has got to be rum or whiskey. He is being held from behind by what appears to be the devil, horns and all. And then on the top of this column, there's this ferocious bird breathing fire or something down on both the devil and the man. Now, looking at this, I can only imagine that this is a representation of the Seattle Seahawks vanquishing the evil New England Patriots and their coach Bill Belichick. But I would probably be wrong because that's not going to happen for a few weeks. So I got to ask, what is this picture?
Yeah, and also, I mean, if it was actually predicting the 2015 Super Bowl, it would be prophetic by about two centuries.
Oh, that'd be awesome. So it's about 17.
That would be if we could link it back there. no, this is a great image that I actually found after the book was completed.
Hmm.
So I don't get a chance to talk about it in the book, but I love it when it comes up in interviews like this one. So this is a political cartoon. It turns out there were a few political cartoons done in the 1790s, 1800s, not too many, but the ones that have survived are pretty interesting. So this one's 1802. I think we can identify the guy in the middle actually as Tom Paine. Tom Paine, who is, many Americans remember him as being the guy who writes Common Sense, The Present Crisis, these really pro-revolutionary essays. But over the next 20 years, his reputation really, really declines in the country. He writes a really bitter attack actually against Christianity and the Bible in the 1790s. He goes to France and celebrates the French Revolution. And then by the time he's come back after 1800, he starts writing more essays against the government and against the United States. And so how Americans view him has really going downhill. And so you mentioned there are some word bubbles, kind of hard to read.
Yeah, I couldn't read those. What do those say?
Yeah, so the key idea here, I think, is here's Tom Paine trying to pull down the federal government, basically. He's trying to overthrow the government. And that bottle at his feet is a bottle of brandy. Lots of people drank in the early Republic, but Tom Paine was known as an intensely heavy drinker. So he was also tarred as a drunkard with everything else. So Paine is saying, oh, I fear it, the federal government is stronger rooted than I expected. But with the assistance of my old friend, the devil, and a little more brandy, I will bring it down, right? So he's trying to overthrow the government.
Hmm.
And then the devil, right, that is the devil there, giving help, says, pull away, my dear son, and don't fear. I will give you all of my assistance. And then that bird is probably the American Eagle. It's not a Seattle Seahawk, but it is the American Eagle trying to fight back against this attack on the government.
Now, there are two names that are written on that column, and it's Washington and Adams.
Right.
The first two presidents, so I assume that's symbolic in some way.
I think it's indicative of the way that this very much a Federalist writer is saying the government was established so well by these first two presidents, and now Paine is trying to take it down. And what I like about this cartoon is the way it really suggests that people saw the political debates of the time about the shape of the government and about the course of the nation in very much religious terms. That the fight was not simply with political opponents who might see things differently, but it was a spiritual conflict. That it was actually the devil working behind the scenes to attack the government. So there's quite a lot at stake in the politics of the new nation.
Now, you mentioned you found that cartoon after you had polished off the manuscript and probably did all the copy editing and that, but the publisher let you put it onto the cover anyways. That's pretty cool.
They did. They must have thought it did a good job of capturing the ideas, and I think it does too. I think it's a great, very striking image that I hope will grab people and say, boy, what's going on? I had better read this book.
Yeah, well, there a lot of publishers don't let authors choose their own covers, and so you should be very honored with that one as well. And it is too bad after everything was all copy edited, and if anybody knows this whole process, once you go through the copy editing process and you clear up all the little punctuations and all that, the publishers don't want you to touch it whatsoever again. So it comes in late, and you don't get to discuss what that cover means, but it will get people wondering.
That's right. Hopefully they'll dig into it and they'll say, we should listen to this. We should listen to Research on Religion and learn about it more.
Absolutely. So we have the exclusive here explaining the cover photo. I can claim that. And it's pretty cool that you're doing this topic of federalism and religion in the late 18th, early 19th century. How did you ever come to study something like this? Where does your fascination in the religious political aspects of this era come into play?
Yeah, well, I think it started really with the interest in the Revolution, right? Some of our other podcasts have been about the Revolution. It's a fascinating time period. And as I was in graduate school and studying the Revolution, it really struck me, wait a minute, not everything was decided between, say, 1763 and 1776 with independence, and even 1787-88 with the U.S. Constitution. There was a lot going on, a lot that's very much worth studying, but by the time you get to the Constitution, you get a governmental framework set up, then the first Congress puts the First Amendment into place. Okay, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. But what did that mean? So I actually came to realize that a lot of decisions that would be made for the country weren't made until the new government was in place. So the 1790s, the 1800s, the 1810s. And so there's a lot of shifting patterns happening after the Constitution is in place. And so I found that really, really interesting. And it became even more enjoyable because since Americans did not know what was going to happen, they argued about it really, really intensely. And I just, you know, enjoyed the newspaper polemics with where people are calling each other all kinds of names. I said, this is good dramatic stuff. I can work with this for a while.
Yeah, people don't really realize how vitriolic that a lot of the political dialogue was at that time. We oftentimes think that our age is the only time this big bipartisan rift is occurring and tearing the country asunder, but it certainly was the case back then. And as you're a historian, I'm a political scientist, and us political scientists do know that, yeah, you can write down the formal rules of the Constitution, but you know, right after those rules are drying there on the paper, people are going to start debating about what they actually mean. They're going to start to bend them their own way. And right there in the initial phases of figuring out what the whole Constitution means and how we're going to govern our nation, it very high stakes politics, and things are going to get pretty rough and tumble.
Yeah, and I think it was because lots of Americans cared quite a bit, but they also didn't know the future, right? We can say, well, you know, after some rocky first start, this country is going to be growing for the next two centuries. They don't know that. They have every fear that this could collapse into some sort of ruin within a couple of decades, and so it really matters what they're going to do.
Now, let me remind folks again about the title. It is Patriotism and Piety, Federalist Politics and Religious Struggle in the New American Nation. And subtitles are always important. So discuss this. And before we get into the religious struggle part, explain to us who these Federalists were, because the Federalists of that time were not necessarily advocates of federalism, so as we kind of understand it today. So the terms kind of get a little bit confusing for some folks, including myself, so clear that up for us.
Yeah, I think that's the first step, is to understand who are these guys. Because, in fact, you might say there are two related Federalist movements. They really take their name in the era of the debate over the Constitution, where the Federalists are the ones who want the new Constitution, which is actually more giving more power to the national government than had the Articles of Confederation. So they're not trying to wipe out or eliminate the states, but they do want to give more power to the national government. But in a kind of twist of labels, they take the federal term. So they're the Federalists. And the way I think most people would come to this would be the Federalist Papers, right? The essays written by James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay in support of the Constitution. So that's the kind of the first meaning of the Federalist. But then many of these supporters of the Constitution carry over into the new government, into the 1790s, and they become one of the country's first political parties. I mean, there's a way in which they are the first political party. They are the party that gives leadership to the new nation right out of the blocks. Because in that sense, George Washington was a Federalist. John Adams was a Federalist. Alexander Hamilton was a Federalist. So these are pretty big figures from the Revolution who are kind of spurring this new organization forward. Now, when people talk about what were the Federalists interested in, they usually say, well, governmental power, getting the army and the navy going. People will often talk about Alexander Hamilton's financial plans. Let's develop a industrial country, one that encourages industry and the government is on the side of economic development. Questions like this. But my claim is that there's also a concern about culture and religion in Federalist ideology that we really haven't talked about before, and that I would hope this would make people realize, wait a minute, the Federalists also had religious concerns, and so we better tell that as part of our story from the new nation as well.
And that's what we are going to start doing in your book, that's the piety part, but there's also the patriotism part, and in the title of your book, Patriotism and Piety. Explain what the patriotism is all about. This is a time where people are trying to sort out what it means to be a patriotic American. I mean, I can imagine that for a lot of people, they're unaware of what's going on, and they don't necessarily feel like they're part of an American nation yet.
Yeah, I think that definitely goes into it. I would start off by saying that patriotism and piety tag was also something that I discovered. So it's not simply here are some good words to throw into the mix, but people at the time were using that phrase, patriotism and piety.
Hmm.
And in fact, one of the Federalists who gets a lot of attention in the book is a man named Caleb Strong. And when he retired, his friends gathered up his speeches and they said the title for this collection should be Patriotism and Piety. And I said, ah, that's what's going on here. That's what we should try to think about. So on just the patriotism side, I think that's right, that they are trying to develop a vision of the nation, right? What are our kind of loyalties to, or what's our identity? And they would say we need to have a stronger identity as an American nation. And that's the type of patriotism we should have. And this gets especially sharpened when they feel like the country is under attack. And they would say, you know, we could be led astray by going back to kind of a British monarchism, or even more dangerously, into the very, very kind of democratic excesses of the French Revolution. And we don't want that. So we want a new type of American patriotism.
Yeah, that is a good point, because we often lose fact that around the time of the U.S. War of Independence, that the French Revolution starts to take hold. I mean, actually, after the war, you have the French Revolution, 1789, kicking off, and you know, it's a pretty rocky 1790s there in France, and largely because we teach American history separate from European history, we lose the fact that these two things are probably related to some extent. Was the French Revolution really on people's mind that much in the new American Republic?
It's incredibly on their mind. This is a big theme that I keep coming back to, is people see what's going on. Now, at first, many Americans are optimistic. In the first couple of years, they're hopeful this is going to be a revolution like theirs. And so there's initial optimism. But then the reports start coming in about the terror, right, which is 1793-94. It's when the guillotine is really active. King Louis is killed. Queen Marie Antoinette is killed. And you know, you start to hear about hundreds and even thousands of people being executed by the French state. And very quickly, the Federalists say, "Whoa, this is dangerous. We have to do everything to buttress ourselves against this." And then they say, "But wait a minute, what about these other Americans who are still celebrating the French? Do they want to have the same effect here? Do they want to set up guillotines in America?" And so they start calling their Democratic Republican opponents Jacobins, just like the French revolutionaries. And so they see the political debates very much as inflected by the French Revolution. And this gets even stronger in 1797, 1798, when for a brief moment it looks like we the United States, might go to war against the French. And then it very much is, let's show our American character and tar anybody who likes the French with this very much non-American label.
Now, one of the other things that happens in the French Revolution in you mentioned that thousands of people were guillotined, but it wasn't only just thousands of people. A lot of them were clergy. A lot of them were priests, and one could see an attack against the religious establishment going on. And now, again, it was a Catholic religious establishment there, but one could see the people influenced by Jacobin ideologies as taking on all religions in other places. Did that loom large here in the American debate?
Yeah, very, very much so. I think that French historians like to talk about the movement of de-Christianization. And there's even a moment when the Jacobin French revolutionaries establish a kind of religion or a cult of reason. And they celebrate it in, of all places, the Cathedral of Notre Dame. And they kind of set up their own ceremonies to celebrate the goddess of reason. And so Americans look at this, especially Federalists look at this, and they say, this is really dangerous, that we've been saying you need Christianity supporting the Republic, and here these Jacobins, whether they're French or American Jacobins, trying to undermine Christianity. So then the fight over Christianity and the fight over Christianity in public takes on very much a political dimension.
And so that becomes the piety and religious struggle aspect of your title. Tell us a little bit more about this religious struggle. Were there denominational differences between this? Was it just the really churchy people versus Thomas Paine, who was a deist or been anti-religious person? I'm not exactly sure where he was standing on things. So what's this whole religious struggle about that you talk about in your title of your book?
Yeah, so I pick that up to really push against the, maybe it's just a popular notion, but that very much the period of revolution was mostly a time of religious consensus, that kind of everybody just kind of linked arms and they got together and that wasn't a big issue. Well, what I discovered digging into the sources was people are arguing over all kinds of religious matters and taking all kinds of religious stances. So that the early republic is a place of competition between religious groups, right? You talk about a free market of religious competition. But even more so, the conflict is really heated. And part of that is what's going to be believed. What kind of religious ideals are out there? So, within Christian groups, you have the Calvinist versus Arminian arguments. Those are very heated. But you also see new religious groups popping up. In New England, you see Unitarians coming onto the scene. And Unitarians are those who say God is unitary or unified, and so Jesus is not divine. And so this earns a huge argument from the traditional people who say Christ is divine and is part of the Trinity. Another set of voices that keep coming up are the group that get labeled at that time infidels. And so infidels are anyone who is maliciously undermining Christianity or belief in the Bible. And so Tom Paine would count as an infidel, because in his book, The Age of Reason, he said, you can't believe the Bible at all, right? It's a book of myths. And so people who would read Paine, or they might also read the American Revolutionary Ethan Allen, who said reason is the only thing we can trust. And so they would say, oh, these voices are undermining Christianity, and if we let them get a foothold, then really bad things are going to happen, not only for our churches, but for the state. And so, in fact, one of my chapters is called The Politics of Infidelity, right? How does infidelity become a political category? So there are all these theological divides. The other debate is, how should the churches relate to the state? And so some people are saying we need to keep some sort of establishment set up. Others are saying we need to separate the church and the state much more strongly than they have. And so there are arguments also on kind of the social impact of their religious beliefs.
So you mentioned that you have a chapter called The Politics of Infidelity, and again, in the title of your book, you're intertwining federalist politics with this religious struggle. So let's dive into that, and tell me how federalist politics, or their religious world, political worldview, becomes intertwined with this religious struggle.
That, I think, is one of the main burdens of the book that I'm setting out to prove. And I think the short answer is that Federalists had this cultural view that also made a role for religious concerns. So they really are interested in thinking about the relation of the new government and culture that they're building to the religion of the times. Now, and to be frank, mostly that was Protestant Christianity. Now, there were other groups. There were groups of Catholics and groups of Jews in America at the time. But for the most part, we're still in a mode of thinking about Protestant Christianity. So the Federalists generally believed that a healthy culture needed some sort of public religiosity. Now, that could be achieved without an establishment at the national level. Right, they're not arguing for a national church. But if your state wanted to have an established church, they actually thought that was a pretty good idea. And that was the case in Massachusetts and Connecticut and New Hampshire at this time, and to a lesser extent further south. So a public religiosity, they thought, was a good thing. They varied in how they defined it. So on one hand, I said there's this common Federalist concern for what I call public religiosity. But then amongst different Federalists, they would have slightly different emphases about how you would get there. And the other thing is, I claim that how they tried to relate their religion, their politics, evolved over time. So in the 1780s, growing out of the American Revolution, it's very much in continuity with where it was during the Revolution. I call this a Republican outlook, that they thought religion and politics go together pretty well. You don't need to really mess with the details because it's just harmonious. That was the first step. Then in the 1790s, as you get infidel voices coming in, you get the French Revolution. They say, whoa, we need to have a much more forthright or robust religious presence. And so it becomes much more combative. In how they put it forward. It's much more in your face, much more direct. And that I think is the tone of the 1790s. Now, as they move into the 1800s, though, the Federalists begin to lose more elections than they win, right? You think 1800, Thomas Jefferson actually defeats John Adams, the Federalist candidate, and even though the Federalists will put forward other candidates for the presidency, they're not going to win another election at the national level. They'll win election to the Senate or to the House of Representatives, but they're not going to really be the national party that they were ahead of time. And so I see a lot of them begin to shift to a final stage, which is to encourage a voluntarist engagement, to say we're not really going to do this politically as much as we're going to do this through voluntary societies. And we're going to shape society through organizations, and that way is how we're going to preserve the republic. So they also develop over time.
Now, this story begins to sound familiar because on our previous podcast, you talked to us about John Jay, and he was one of the individuals who removes himself from politics and begins to emphasize that voluntary aspect of all this. Who are some of the major players in this Federalist move toward voluntarism in the 1800s?
Jay is important. Jay, I think, is one of the two biggest people to think about with this voluntarist turn, where he's active in politics. He retires in 1801, and then the energies that he has left, he invests in voluntary societies, such as the American Bible Society. And maybe we should say a little bit more about the American Bible Society. I think it becomes kind of the best example of this voluntarist turn, because when it's founded in 1816, it brings together lots of former Federalists, and it says we're going to have a national organization with state chapters. And so very much it mirrors the format of the Constitution, that just as the Federalists thought in kind of a national government, so you have a national organization that then has state-level branches that are supported at the grassroots level. So they're really saying we can build these institutions that will gain their energy from the citizens at the grassroots. So Jay's great because John Jay is the second president of the American Bible Society. Well, the first president of the American Bible Society is a man named Elias Boudinot, who's from New Jersey. Now, it turns out Elias Boudinot is also a Federalist. And I said, whoa, when I saw this in the archives, this is exciting. Because Boudinot, same thing. He wants a religious republic, but the way he decides ultimately he's got to get there is with the American Bible Society and with voluntary societies working in kind of the cultural arena, not the political arena. And so I think the Federalists really say, ah, this is how we're going to leave our mark. And in fact, I think they leave a longer term mark in the cultural and voluntary arena than they do in the political arena. So there's a little bit of an irony there.
Is this the vibe that Alexis de Tocqueville picks up on when he visits America? Because he's traveling around America in, what, the 1810s, 1820s?
Tocqueville's actually in the 1830s.
1830s, much later. So yeah, he's totally picking up on this vibe.
But he's definitely picking up on this. And in fact, this is, I think, one of the big takeaways is that it's the Federalists who have this institutional mindset who are then saying, we need to, the way we're going to hold our republic together, especially as it grows more democratic, that was Tocqueville's concern, is with these voluntary societies that we have to find ways to create ties that will connect individuals in society and connect the nation together. And so they're the ones pioneering these insights. And then 20 years later, when Tocqueville comes along, he's very much, I think, witnessing the fruits of their endeavors.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the other big issues at the time is it's not only what we do with churches and whether they should be established at the national level or at the state level or at all. Another big issue that is tugging in a lot of different directions in this new republic is that the issue of slavery. Fairly contentious during the Constitutional Convention, stays on the national agenda until it eventually leads to a civil war, roughly a half century later. Where do the Federalists come down on this, and did their view of religion help to shape the way that they interacted with this issue?
It did, and this was another theme that I found really interesting. I would say, on the whole, the Federalists are actually divided on slavery. That there you can see both perspectives within the party. Right? It's this is one of those great moments you can say, well, not everybody agreed, and that makes it interesting. So if you look to the South, I have several South Carolinians in the study. And they actually develop a pretty robust pro-slavery outlook that is informed by their religious opinions and their view of society. So, not surprisingly, Southern slaveholding Federalists will really argue strongly in favor of slavery. But I think the more interesting development happens in the North, where it's the Federalists who are some of the first who come out as anti-slavery people. Again, the Jay family is really interesting in this. So it's John Jay, who's governor of New York, when they pass the bill leading to the ending of slavery in New York. So Jay has been advocating for an anti-slavery move since the American Revolution. He finally gets it in the 1790s. It's John Jay's son, William Jay, who really takes the fight forward. So in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s, William Jay, John Jay's son, becomes a decided abolitionist. And so he is really writing pamphlet after pamphlet after pamphlet to try to convince Americans that they should oppose slavery and that they should find ways to do away with it. Two kind of interesting hooks there, I think. One is just as a matter of involvement, it's possible that the Jay House became a stop on the Underground Railroad. That's kind of hard to certify, but it seems very likely from the sources. The other thing that I find interesting for both John and especially William is how much their anti-slavery was inspired by their Christian ideals, their Protestant ideals. They were both Episcopalians, but they had a very strong concern that justice and Christianity demanded an end to slavery. So they really worked very hard against it.
And that's rather interesting because we hear a great deal about the Quakers and the Mennonites being abolitionist and taking some pretty radical actions in that regard. But you mentioned Episcopalians here too, which were also present in the South. So how, I mean, that must have been a bitter issue within the Federalists. Does it really tear this group apart and get them moving in different directions over the course of time?
Right. Now, the party, because it's disintegrating, never has to confront their party commitment to slavery or against slavery. But it's an interesting moment to see there are these groups pulling in different directions, that slavery is a fracture line for the party, as is some theological commitment. So not when some of these religious debates are happening within the Federalists as well. But for someone like William Jay, yes, he actually has a number of pamphlets directed against his own denomination, right? And he says we have to both first fight the general acceptance of slavery, but then he goes a step further to say even in our Episcopal denomination, we need to repent of what he calls the sin of caste, by which he means any racial divide. So he has come to a point where he is arguing for very much no racial discrimination. And this is in the 1830s, and I find that a really great insight that's developed from the experience of religion and the Federalist Party.
Yeah, it much deeper in our history than most people would think that it is. Now, your book is populated with a lot of great characters and stories. You just mentioned here William Jay, John Jay, we've talked about before. You gave us a little taste of Elias Boudinot, who happened to be French, right? Boudinot comes from a French family, I would assume.
He's a Huguenot. That's right.
Okay. He's
so
a French Protestant.
His family had come over from France several centuries before. And actually, the Jay family has some Huguenot blood, as do some of my South Carolinians, Henry William Desessour. So it's very interesting that they can cherish their French heritage and yet be terrified by what they hear is going on in France at the time.
Yeah, they're probably very well positioned to be leaders or popular movers within the Federalist movement, I can imagine. But you have some other folks, and I want to talk about some of these, and it very leads to some very interesting conspiracy theories and unusual moments in history. Those are always fun to talk about. In particular, you write about two ministers Timothy Dwight and Jedediah Morse, who go ballistic over the Illuminati. And this is something that is on our radar screen now because Katy Perry, who is hosting the Super Bowl halftime, is very much concerned about them. So tell us about these folks and maybe illuminate Katy Perry about the Illuminati.
There we go. I would like nothing better than to do exactly that. Where to start with this? So I was talking about this group that the Federalists are really afraid of, the Illuminati. And some of my students said, oh, like Katy Perry. And I said, what do we mean by this? Well, you know, so this is one good way, one good benefit of teaching. It keeps you connected to all kinds of different developments in culture that one wouldn't otherwise know about.
When your students brought up Katy Perry, did you know who they were talking about?
I knew the name.
Yeah.
I consider myself cool enough to have known who she was.
Oh, that's cool.
So after some research, it turns out that Katy Perry, who is this pop singer, in case our listeners don't know, and as you said, she's going to be at the Super Bowl, but has grown this fascination with the Illuminati. And apparently in some of her music videos, she's used Illuminati symbolism. One of the best examples is the all-seeing eye, right? The eye in the triangle, which is actually on our, you know, dollar bill.
Oh, yeah. I know that. I always tape over that just to make sure it's not watching me.
There you go. It is kind of disturbing.
On the pyramid. It's floating. It's not just an eye. It's a floating on top of the pyramid somehow. Yeah.
Right. And so she's using imagery like that, and she's also been quoted in articles saying, if the Illuminati exists, I'd really like to be invited. I'd like to be a part of them.
Yay! Yeah, they'd probably throw a good party. I mean, floating pyramids.
I guess so. All the literature says they do.
Yeah.
Right. So if in case she starts disappearing for days on end to undisclosed locations, they may have gotten a hold of her. Well, so there's actually a connection to the Federalists, right? So pop culture, but it actually relates back to what we're talking about today. In the sense that as the French Revolution was getting going, there were a couple of books published in England that said, do you know what the problem is? What caused the French Revolution? It was a conspiracy that was started by a group called the Bavarian Illuminati. And these Bavarian Illuminati apparently were supposed to have adapted very rationalist ideals, kind of Enlightenment ideals, and dedicated themselves to undermining religion and governments across the world. And once they undermine religion, then they'll be able to create revolution and gain power that way. So that was the thinking. Now, there really was a Bavarian Illuminati. We can say there was a group formed in Bavaria. But now, did they become a national underground or international underground force for evil? Probably not. So just because people were talking about it doesn't mean they were actually as powerful as people thought. These books were published in England, and some of the first people to read these books were ministers, among them Timothy Dwight and Jedediah Morse. Now, these are not just kind of random pastors who happen to be in the bookstore and pick this up. Timothy Dwight is the president of Yale College and is himself the grandson of the great theologian Jonathan Edwards. So he's a pretty respectable guy. Jedediah Morse is a pastor in eastern Massachusetts. We also remember him as one of America's first geographers. He published a number of geographies, as well as being a minister. So these guys are very well positioned to make noise. And what they start preaching sermons, 1798, about why the Illuminati are so dangerous. And my suggestion is it's because they see them as attacking this kind of public religiosity that they thought would be necessary to preserve the Republic. And they go through multiple sermons that are really barn burners to warn people against the Illuminati. And actually, in thinking about this, I actually pulled out one of Timothy Dwight's sermon. So if I could just read this, he probably delivered it better than me. But Timothy Dwight, 1798, says, "For what end shall we be connected with these men? Right, kind of these French and these Illuminati. Right, is it that we may assume the same character and pursue the same conduct? Is it that our churches may become temples of reason, our Sabbath a decade, our psalms of praise, Marseillaise hymns? Is it that we may change our holy worship into a dance of Jacobin frenzy, that we may behold a strumpet personating a goddess on the altars of Jehovah? Is it that we may see the Bible cast into the bonfire, or our children taught to chant mockeries to God, right? Shall we, my brethren, become partakers of these sins? Shall we introduce them into our government, our schools, our families? Shall our sons become the disciples of Voltaire, the dragoons of Marat, or our daughters the concubines of the Illuminati?" So that's pretty dramatic rhetoric. That would get people's attention.
Oh, absolutely. The dragoons part, too. That sounds, yep, that sounds horrid. Dragoons. What is a dragoon, by the way? I know what a dragon is, and I know what a doubloon is. A dragoon is not a coin with a dragon on it, is it?
No, that would be great, though. It's a foot soldier.
Ah.
Right. Shall we arm them and take our families and basically make them the marching forces of unbelief and destruction of our republic? And of course, Dwight says no. Right. We have to repent and work for, we have to organize, basically, for a Christian response so we don't go down this path. Now, it turns out, and, you know, it'd be great to just leave us wound up there, it turns out that the Illuminati kind of conspiracy burns out pretty quickly. In about 2 years, no one is talking about the Illuminati anymore. But the passion that Dwight and Morse are expressing for kind of a preserved religious republic continue. So the Illuminati conspiracy kind of dies away, but the ideals live on. And so I guess my response for the Super Bowl, and we'll see if this happens, I'm kind of doubting that it won't, but it would be great to tell Katy Perry, no, you probably don't want to hang out with these guys, but if you do want to give a shout out to my book during this halftime show, that would be A-okay.
you can post it up there. All the people with the placards in the stands, that'll hold it up, and it can have the cartoon there warning Katy Perry of the Dragoons of Marat and the Temple of Reason. I noticed that was in Dwight's sermon as well. And as you mentioned, he's, you know, president of Yale, and you think, well, university reason and all that kind of stuff. But again, the rhetoric at the time, Temple of Reason, has a very sinister tone to it, that they're warning of oncoming French Revolution and the turning away from God.
Yeah, they're referring exactly back to what the Jacobin de-Christianization that had happened in France.
So how about some of these other folks that you have in your book? And we've touched upon some of them, but there's some really good stories here. One of the other guys that you talk about is this Elias Boudinet, who was the first president of the American Bible Society. But he's also pretty well known for writing to his daughter from the floor of Congress. Tell us who this guy is and how he helps to shape the Federalist Movement in addition to the American Bible Society.
Yeah, the story I start off my chapter on Boudinot with is him writing his daughter. So just to give you an overview, he's a lawyer when the American Revolution breaks out. He comes to support the Washington and his army while they're in New Jersey. He's very much involved in helping take care of American prisoners of war. From there, he goes on to, he's elected to the Continental Congress. And from there, he's actually elected president of the Continental Congress. In fact, he is the president who receives the peace treaty from Paris that says we're an independent nation. So he's a pretty important figure in the revolutionary period in his own right.
But we forget about him.
but we forget about, right? He's a secondary figure. So we say, oh, how important was he? Well, in his day, he was really important. Then once the Constitution is in place, New Jersey once again elects him to go back to the House of Representatives. He serves for three terms in the House of Representatives before serving in a couple other governmental agencies and then retiring and then later being involved in the American Bible Society. Well, I found this great letter in the archives where he says, I'm sitting in Congress, all kinds of business is going around me, but dear daughter Susan, I want to know what is the condition of your immortal soul? And so he spends this whole letter asking her, you know, what is your condition of faith? How have you responded to the message of the gospel? Where are you on this? And to me, that really brought together in a different way this concern for both religious belief and politics, right? Here's a political figure very much concerned about his daughter, right? That it's both the state of her soul and the soul of the state. Both of those things go together. And in fact, he'll continue this campaign to protect his daughter and really protect all of the children in America. When Tom Paine wrote his book Against the Bible, Boudinot also published a book in response. Tom Paine said, it's the age of reason. Elias Boudinot said, no, it's not. It's the age of revelation. And so he said, I'm writing this so that young people, especially my daughter, won't be seduced by infidel belief, but that, in fact, they'll renew their Christian belief, which will then have important political concerns. And in case people are worried, it does appear that that faith stuck with his daughter, Susan. She lived a very long life and was very involved in her church in New Jersey until the day she died.
Oh, that's a good story. Actually, that story, the fact that you find that letter is very revealing, especially for somebody like me. I'm a political scientist. I look at political interests a lot and often approach them with a very cynical nature that, you know, a lot of the rhetoric that we hear about religiosity is just merely manipulation for people to win this constituency or that constituency. But this letter written on the floor of Congress with great passion really indicates that for Elias Boudinot, as well as many of these other folks, this is their political life, their personal life, their spiritual life is just woven into one tapestry.
That's right. There's a lot of continuity, and I think that counts for a lot of the figures in the book. And you know, we should say, is there room for some skepticism and cynicism? Sure, right. I don't want to give that up. And were there some people interested in manipulating Christianity for political ends? Definitely. There's some appearance that it looks like Alexander Hamilton would have liked to have kind of used some of that language simply for his political ends. But for a lot of these people, no, it really did grow out of a very sincere commitment.
Now let me ask you this as we come near the end of our discussion here. You talk about something known as the federalization of American Christianity. We've talked about the influence that Christianity plays in the Federalist movement, but there's a two-way street here with politics shaping the religious landscape as well. And what do you mean about that term, federalization of American Christianity?
Right. On one level, I was trying to be a little bit clever. The people who know the literature about America and American religious history and American politics will know that Nathan Hatch, who's currently the president of Wake Forest, about 20 years ago published a great book called The Democratization of American Christianity, which is really a classic study. Highly recommended. I would highly recommend it to the audience. But I argue that there's something else going on, that the encounter of bringing in these Federalist leaders actually brought in a new dynamic into the practice of Christianity in America at this time. And that was ultimately this notion that we could build these voluntary societies and that simply having people have beliefs was not sufficient, but we could think on an institutional and structural level. And so the federalization was the idea of building voluntary societies like the American Bible Society or the American Tract Society or others that would be kind of institutional in their organization of spreading the Christian message. And so I think this would be a tie-in that would be really interesting to sociologists, political scientists who are talking about kind of a new institutional perspective, right? Bringing institutions back into the story. In fact, it was the Federalists who understood that religion needed institutions to continue to thrive.
What does that say about our life today? You just mentioned Nathan Hatch, who is alive and well today and writing about this. But, you know, we look at your book. It has a nice cartoon on the cover, very provocative. You talk about the institutionalization of religion by the American Bible Society and the Tract Society and John Jay and other folks like that. But is this having any impact on our society today? What are your thoughts on that?
Right. Well, first of all, I want to be a faithful historian and describe the past accurately, right? That was my first job. But in the process, I think there is there are several contemporary takeaways. The big one I think that people can see is that debates about religion and politics are nothing new, right? That you know, we think, people bringing their religious beliefs into the public arena, that's new. No, it's actually not, right? That there's been a long-standing history of that. On the other hand, there's also a long-standing history of people arguing about it. So when we come up to arguments and people say, I don't like how deploying that religious argument, right? Funny, this does happen on one or two blogs here and there. We should also not be surprised by that in fact, the argument is kind of built into the American experience. And so we shouldn't shy away from either people using religious language or the fact of other people challenging them and debating with them. And that, in fact, I think our republic is actually strengthened by those debates about what is the common good, and that thinking about religion in those terms is not a bad thing.
What other things have you learned throughout this process? As I opened up the interview, I mentioned that you had the opportunity to open the box and see your book in your hands, and that's always a wonderful feeling. But writing a book, as you know, is a very long process, and it can change your mind on a lot of things, things that you were pretty sure of, and we're going to sit down and write this out. But the more you think about it, the more you change your mind on something. Did you have any of those moments in the whole process of this, and what were they?
Yeah, I'm not sure these were dramatic 180 changes, but I do think the whole process and reflecting on it gave me a couple of other insights, and these are probably worthwhile things for all of us to think about. But one of them is, once again, the value of mediating institutions or civil society. That I think that the Federalists understood this, and I guess I think in our day it would be really great to renew that commitment. That it's a very good thing to have organizations that are public but not political. That really does help us build social capital, right? To riff on Robert Putnam, and further, they're mediating in the sense that they help protect individuals from other more powerful institutions, such as the state. So I think if anything, the study has really inspired my greater appreciation of civil society. That would be one piece. The other is the recognition of how do we kind of rank these concerns about religion, politics, society, culture. And I think what the Federalists came to discover, even as they were losing elections and which may be useful for people to think about today, is how culture generally is upstream from politics, or that religion is, religious commitments, whatever they are prior to political commitments. And so it's probably not enough to simply win a political argument if you are simultaneously ignoring the cultural wellsprings of politics. So the Federalists actually, even in their losing, they have a good lesson for us.
Well, those are lessons that I think we all can abide from, and I think we could even learn more by picking up your book, Patriotism and Piety, by Jonathan Den Hartog. Jonathan, it's been great having you on Research on Religion.
Well, once again, thanks so much, Tony. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.